Romans chapter 7, and we're looking at the initial opening parts of the third paragraph in the chapter, where Paul is dealing specifically with life in relation to law as he has developed his thesis through this whole section. Chapter 6 was about grace, chapter 7 about law, and chapter 8 is about the Spirit. And those are the three big ticket items in terms of Paul's view or teaching on sanctification. So, last time we were looking at his declaration in verse 13 that the question was a natural question to arise at the beginning of verse 13 because he says, did that which is good become a matter of death for me? And that's on the heels of the fact that verse 10 says point blankly, the commandment which was supposed to result in life proved to result in death for me. So the question, did that which is good become a basis for death for me, seems to be an automatic based on what is apparent in verse 10. But his answer catches us a little off guard because he says, no, it may never be. But then he goes ahead and pushes the issues down to where they actually rest, and that is sin's deceptive use of the commandment. The commandment was supposed to result in life, and it technically didn't result in death until sin deceived Paul. That's verse 11. And then with the deceptive use or application of law, a misapplication actually corrupts the essence of law and turns it into not law. In other words, it wasn't the law that killed him. It was the deceptive use of it, and that meant that it was a perversion of law. And so technically he's absolutely right when he says, may it never be, because the sin is the issue, and it apparently needs to be known as extremely, extraordinarily sinful. And that's what he says. Sin, in order that it might be shown to be sinful, that word sin is the noun, but I think it's being used in an adjectival sense. He's trying to say that sin needs to be extraordinarily evil in our eyes by affecting death through what's good, so that the commandment, through the commandment, sin can be seen as utterly sinful. And that whole idea that it needs to be seen that way is a strong implication that we need to take sin seriously at every level. And you know, it's a human failing, I think, to reduce the gravity of sin in many, 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 many settings. And I've even heard it said in Genesis 3 that the sin that came upon the whole world just because Adam ate the fruit of the tree seems to be overkill in terms of what he actually did, but it's not. That's just the human way of dismissing the utter sinfulness thing. So that's where we were in our study last time, that human beings have to understand the extraordinary sinfulness of sin. And this evening we just want to pursue that thought, because in verses 14 and following, he actually develops that thought. He says in verse 14, we know that the law is spiritual, but I'm of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. So this is the beginning of the rest of the paragraph that goes all the way to the end of the chapter, and it is the foundation for those puzzling statements in verses 15 and following about how he wants to do good, but he doesn't do it, and he doesn't want to do bad, but he does do it, and it's not really him that's doing it, and all that kind of stuff. And we'll work through every one of those studies if the Lord gives us opportunity and the time. But for this evening, verse 14 is crucial for the foundation of the rest of that. So that's where we're going to look at verse 14 and try to understand how the law is spiritual and how Paul is of flesh or fleshly, and what this sold into bondage issue connected to fleshliness is all about. So I'd like to start by saying that when he says, for we know, he is saying that there is something here that is at the root of it unarguable, at least for his audience. In other words, when he says, for we know, he's just assuming that they do know this. And he's assuming that they won't disagree with him, that they and he both know this. That's an assumption that I mean, he can't write, we know something in terms he uses, unless whatever is known is really an admitted fact by the people that he's writing to, because if he says, for we know, and somebody says, well, I don't know that, and I don't agree with it, well, then it shoots down his whole statement. The fact is, Paul's writing to the Romans was a letter written to a mixed group in terms of their exposure to Jewish law and to law in general, because there were a lot of Jews in Rome, but there were also a lot of Gentiles in the church in Rome. But from chapters 2 and 3, we understand that he really zeroed in on the Jewish knowledge, and he's assuming that those people in the church that were Jewish had already influenced the thinking of the Gentiles in that group too, so that they knew at least some of the Old Testament issues of Judaism and law. So he's addressing people who are significantly aware of the principle of law. And the words follow hard on the heels of the statement in verse 12 that the law is holy and the commandment is holy and righteous and good, so that in our consideration here of the law's spirituality, we have a pre-statement about its holiness and righteousness and goodness. And then the fact is that he also is writing some things that are hard on the heels of this, I'm a flesh sold into bondage to sin, because the whole idea here is that the sin uses the law in a deceitful manner in order to produce all manner of sins. So there are two prior contextual issues that are real crucial. And one of them is the spirituality of the law in terms of the goodness of law as a tool. And we have to keep in mind that his focus on the purpose for law is revelation, not regulation. We've said that over and over and over. But the fact is, the law was given, even the commandments that were given, were not designed to be a method of control of people's behavior, because that's impossible. You can't control behavior by commandment. But by commandment, you can reveal what the character of God requires in terms of the issues of his character. So it's revelational in terms of his character. It's revelational in terms of our failure. It's revelational. And that's crucial, because he's going to be saying a bunch of things in here that are revelational. They really open our eyes if we understand it. And we need to understand that and clearly understand that the issue is revelation. And a lot of times that revelation has to do with the essence of a characterization, particularly of God, but also of men and angels and the rest of creation. And also the revelation of motivation and the actions that come out of motivation. Because Paul said that he wouldn't have known sin except that the law came and said, you shall not lust. And he said, I wouldn't have even known that was a problem if the law hadn't said it. So that, in that sense, is a revelation of motivation and action as something unacceptable to the character of the God who gave it. And then secondly, this issue of Paul talking about his being sold under sin, sold into bondage to sin, that needs to be understood in terms of how he describes himself in the prior paragraph, where he says, I was alive once, but then the commandment came and the sin was resurrected, and then I died. And what's not stated is, I was dead once, then I became alive, then the law came, and then sin was resurrected, and then I died again. He didn't put the first part in there, that he was dead, but he did say, I was alive once, which, biblically, he was dead before he was ever alive, and then his subsequent death came through the deceptiveness of the sin and its use of law. So we have to understand that what he's saying in verse 14 about his fleshliness and the law of spirituality is in the context of his own experience as a relatively new believer who is caught by his own misunderstanding of the law's purpose. This is probably where he got his understanding of the law's purpose, is through his own stumbling over this thing and falling back into the bondage of death through the deception of misunderstanding of law. That's probably his, out of his own experience, he wrote the book of Galatians, having gone through what they were going through, as it's explained in the book. So, that means then that he wants us to take seriously the reality of the deceit that the sin uses to produce the consequent death on Paul and on us when we revert to legal methodology. And we need to understand he's not describing the experience of an unregenerated person, nor is he talking about the experience of a believer who knows how to walk by the Spirit. He's addressing believers who have come to life but then have been seduced back into a death experience simply because they don't know how to understand law. And that's why he's writing this. That's why chapter 7 is about how we're supposed to relate to law as a revelation rather than a regulation. But bottom line, when he says we know that law is spiritual, he's saying something that cannot be argued, or won't be argued at least by his readers. And the point that he's trying to make is that the law is spiritual. And he's deliberately making a contrast between spiritual and fleshly, because that's the issue. I'm of flesh, is that literally I'm fleshly. So there's a deliberate contrast, spiritual as opposed to, King James word is carnal, but it's fleshly. And Paul uses this contrast between spiritual and carnal to some extensive use in his letters to the Corinthians, because he says, I can't write to you as spiritual, I have to write to you as carnal. So we get some of our understanding of his contrast, verse 14, from his letters to the Corinthians. But the unarguable point that he says we know is that the law is essentially a spiritual reality. And there are two or three things that we can support that or argue it from. One of them is, Jesus himself said that no man had seen God at any time because he's spirit. And because God is pure spirit, there is no physical material reality as we know physical and material, though I'm not sure we even know that reality very well. We know what it means when we're physical and material, but Paul said there is a physical material body, and then there is a spiritual body, and the implication is there's going to be a body, which implies some kind of structural reality that we now call physical body. And the physical resurrection from the dead implies that there is a physicalness to this whole issue, but it is transformed to immortality and to spirituality, so that though it's still a body, it's essentially different. It's now spiritual, like the law is spiritual. So, the first thing that we can argue is that because God is pure spirit, anything that actually came from him would be spiritual, at least at the beginning of the process. I mean, when God originally created angels, they were spirits, and there was no flaw in that spirituality. And when God created humanity, though he did create him lower than the angels, which implies that there is something that makes them not quite as spiritual in terms of... And when I use the word spiritual, I'm not implying of necessity anything necessarily good. Paul said to the Ephesians that there are spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenlies. So just being spiritual by itself is not a good thing. It's just a spiritual thing. In other words, it's a contrast between, well, I'll explain what all is involved there, but the issue is human beings were created by God lower than the angels, but there was a spirituality to us because he breathed his spirit into the nostrils of a physical body, and it became then a living soul. And the body without the spirit is dead, so that the spirit is giving life to the body, but the combination of the spirit giving life to the body creates a living condition called a living soul. So there is a spirituality in anything that God is doing. In fact, a lot of our science argues that there's nothing fundamentally material about material stuff. the creation was created by the Word of God. It was there. And He spoke and it was there. And when you take the basic forms of matter as we know it and split them, there's nothing but power left. There's nothing material there. It's just an explosive release of the power that's being held together, according to scriptures, by Jesus Himself. He's holding all things together by the power of His Word. So, God is Spirit. The revelation obviously would be spiritual to start with as a basic, fundamental, simple concept. And then, secondly, the law being spiritual and the law being a revelation rather than a regulation of humanity, there is an issue there of man not grasping the spirituality of the law. Because the immediate distortion of law into a regulation, into a methodology of merit, a methodology of approaching God by obedience and performance issues, that's almost an automatic reaction or result that comes out of the complexity of man's fragmentation. We know that because God created a physical body, breathed a spirit into that, and created a living soul out of that, that the body, soul, and spirit issues are a complexity. We've seen that complexity in chapter 7, where he talks about the male part of us and the female part of us, and both of those are I. And yet, in this paragraph, he says, I do this, but it's not I that does it. And even in Galatians 2:20, the life that I live, it's not I, but Christ that's living in me. Those kind of identity statements, I, reveal the fragmentation. So we can actually say I, when we really only mean my physical body. If a person says, if my heart stops beating, I will be dead, he's only talking about his body, if he's talking in a biblical sense. If a person says, if you walk out the door, my life will be over, I can't live that way, well, they're talking at a relational level there. It doesn't have anything to do with their body life, physical life. And the whole thing with dealing with God in terms of a spiritual kind of identity, we use these terms where the I means me as a body, the I means me as a soul, the I means me as a spiritual being. And so there's a complexity here that just boggles everybody's mind. And when Paul develops this complexity, it's not hard to see how with that kind of complex misunderstanding, human beings fragmented, as Paul already taught in this chapter, that the body is set against the soul is set against the body, the spirit is set against the soul and the body in terms of the objectives of these aspects of man's makeup. This fragmentation and conflict that's internal leads real quickly to a misunderstanding, so that the law is spiritual is an attempt to pull it back to a simplicity. The law is spiritual. It's not physical for your body. It's not soulical for your soul. It's spiritual. And then, that's the issue of the declaration that the law is spiritual, even though Satan was able to use, or the sin was able to use, and those are pretty well equivalent things. The spirit that works in the sons of disobedience is the prince of the power of the air, and he is the one who initiated the sin in the garden. Adam's behavior after Eve's behavior, where Eve was deceived but Adam wasn't, and all of that complexity there. The law as an issue is a dangerous thing because Paul says, I was killed by it. I was killed not by the law as a spiritual reality, but by the law as a deceptive thing in the hands of a deceiver. So dangerous or not, the law is spiritual. But what does he really mean by that? Well, I think that our understanding of spirituality will evolve somewhat as we look at the alternative, the contrast. He says, the law is spiritual. As such, it's already been defined as just and holy and good, especially at the level of the imperative. The commandment is good and is holy and just and good. As a tool of revelation. So, when he talks about the law being spiritual. He's talking about something that is fundamentally holy and righteous and good in terms of its intention, designs, goals, and so on. Spiritual. But the counter thesis is, and the problem area here is, the but I am fleshly. He claims that his susceptibility to deceit, the reason that he was alive once and then died because of the deceptive use of law by the sin, was a result of his fleshliness. He's a flesh. The law is spiritual, but I can't relate to it as a spiritual thing because I am not spiritual. I'm fleshly. And he really does mean that, even though it's technically not true. What I mean by that is, as a believer, he teaches in this book that he's indwelt by the Spirit of God. Because if you don't have the Spirit of Christ in you, you're not one of his. So, in that technical sense, every believer is spiritual in that he has the Spirit of Christ dwelling in his body. But Paul isn't talking about the positional reality. He's talking about the relational reality. Because that's what law is all about. Well, grace and law and spirit is all about relational stuff. So when he says, I'm not spiritual, I'm fleshly, he's not saying the Spirit isn't dwelling in him, but he is saying the Spirit is basically over there in the corner watching, not doing anything. There's no input. And the reason there's no input is because he's not trusting. He's not believing. And without faith, it's impossible to please God, and God is under no obligation to fulfill his promises to people who don't believe him. So at the level of unbelief, he dies. Because that's what breaches the relational interaction between God and men. When there is no trust, there is no relationship. So if God says something and we don't believe him, even if we're his children, we don't have a good working relationship with him because you can't call God a liar and have a good relationship going. It doesn't work that way. So when he says he's fleshly, we need to understand that. The issue of fleshliness is a complex issue. He uses the term flesh and fleshliness through his writings. And the very fact that he's fleshly and it's a complex thing makes it a handy tool for deception. The sin was able to deceive him because it was a complex thing. Even as an apostle, he didn't get all of his understanding of the doctrine of Christ in a flash kind of zapped his brain with this flash memory where he's got it all on there, you know, it's all on the hard drive. He didn't get it that way. In his own testimony, he went to Arabia, and he doesn't tell us how long he was there, but he does tell us that he received the gospel by revelation of Jesus Christ, which the implication is when he was in Arabia, the days and the weeks went by, and he was being tutored by Christ in all of the doctrines that were necessary for him to go out and preach and be an apostle. But that's kind of like going to Bible college or seminary where you get all this information dumped on you and then you send out to use it. Well, it is in the use of it that you learn your most life-governing lessons. It's not in the explanation that somebody gives you. It's in your use of it. And as I've already said, I believe that Romans 7 is the context out of which the book of Galatians was produced. In other words, Paul understood what he was trying to say to the Galatians only after he had had some experience just like theirs. So, given that, the fleshliness is a real issue, and it's interesting that this complexity has to do primarily with the conflict that exists in fallen man, even regenerated fallen man. When we're regenerated, the Spirit of God takes up residence in our body. But his residence in our body does not squelch the appetites of the physical body. And it does not squelch the demandingness of those appetites on the person, the whole person. So that if the body is denied some pleasurable experience or subjected to some painful experience, you can expect that your body is going to rage at you for this. And not you as a body, but you as a soul or spirit or whatever, however you want to define the you there. It's not your physical body because your physical body is screaming at you. Well, given that, the same thing's true of the Spirit's presence in the body. It does not squelch the agenda of the soul, and it doesn't make the appetites of the soul just go away. The soul's commitment is security, and typically security has always been understood by the soul as a relational thing where your security rests in how you're relating to the people around you. And this is where Abraham stumbled so badly when he went to Egypt and he lied about his wife because his sense of insecurity in the presence of Pharaoh, who might take his wife into his harem and kill him in order to do it, all of those things were in his mind, and he hadn't gotten to the point where he could trust God with the promise. God had said, I'm going to make of you a great nation. Well, if Sarah's not pregnant, he's in absolutely zero danger of ever being put to death. It ain't going to happen. And even when he took his son up on Moriah to kill him, we're told that in his own mind, he had reasoned that out to where, if I kill my son as an offering to God, God's going to turn right around and raise him from the dead, because that's the only way I can figure out how he can keep his word, and I'm convinced he's going to keep his word. So there. So the whole point is, the presence of the Spirit in the body of a believer, a regenerated person, doesn't automatically resolve all the issues. The issues are still there, and the resolution of them typically take a lifetime because they're multi-level and there's a gazillion parts. So, it is in this complexity where the flesh is competing with both the soul and the spirit. Peter, for example, says in 1 Peter 2:11 that it is the lusts of the flesh that war against the soul. Well, he's just point blankly telling us that we have a war going on between our bodies, the flesh, and our souls. And James said in James 4 that the hedonisms of our bodies cause all kinds of conflicts among ourselves. Where does the wars and fighting come from? They come from your hedonistic appetites. That's what James said. So we know there's this complex warfare going on within the individual. And that's really why a lot of the rage and anger that we see all day, every day, is an expression not of how badly the person who's raging has been treated, but of how totally unhappy they are within. This week's examples of all of this stuff that's going on and people's raging and they're wanting their Play-Doh and they want their, you know, their dogs that come and let them pet them and make them calm down. All of that is an expression of an inner rage and an inner turmoil that is just being given opportunity to express itself because there are enough of them to get together that they don't figure they'll all get thrown in jail. I mean, that's the human condition, is this manifestation of all this conflict that's going on. And Paul was not exempt from the reality of the anger. Now, he goes on to say in another text, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 44 to 46. 1 Corinthians 15 is the resurrection chapter, and he says in that passage, verses 44 to 46, that there is the King James says a natural body, and there is a spiritual body. And he says the natural body comes first, and then the spiritual. But the word that's translated natural is the word psukikos. It comes from the word psuke, which is our word for soul. And I really believe that what he's saying is that Adam was, the verb is, he became to be. He wasn't created this way, but he became to be. And I think it's through the temptation in Genesis 3. Adam became to be a soul-fixated person. In fact, I think, and this is just my opinion, but I believe that Adam's sin, because he was not deceived, Paul point blankly says, Eve was deceived, Adam was not. Adam's lack of deception was because he had become a soul-fixated person, and the solution to his emptiness of soul and his need for security through relationship fixated on Eve. So that the gift of God became a fixated thing in Adam's mind. And so if he loses Eve, he's going to go back to the only not good thing there was, and that is his aloneness. So given the fact that she's eaten the fruit, and he knows God has said, you eat it, you're dead, he's going to lose his wife. And because he's so fixated, his fixation on his wife has now become dominant in his motivation. He eats it. He breaks his relationship with God in order to try to do something about this breach between him and his wife. And, of course, it doesn't work. It never does. But it says that Adam was a soul. He was made to be a living soul. And I believe that means he was made to live at a soul fixation level. Well, it says in the same text, that was the first Adam. The second Adam is a life-giving spirit. Now, that doesn't mean that we cease to have a soul. It doesn't mean we cease to have a body, because he's talking about the resurrection of the body. And he says there's a soul-fixated body and there's a spiritual body. And the first comes first, and then the second comes after. And the first man, Adam, was a soul-fixated body. He became that. And the second Adam is a life-giving spirit. What he's really driving at there is the issue of fleshliness and spirituality. It boils down to this, the fixation of heart and mind on something less than God. Something maybe God has given us, or perhaps something that we wish we had that he won't give us. In any case, there's a barrier between us and God because we're fixated on something that's completely out of line with the reality of spirituality. So fleshliness is a fixation of the heart and the mind. And because the fleshliness is a matter of fixation, it has to do with motive and action in terms of, if my life is going to consist of being one with this woman who has now breached the barrier of the commandment, I'm either going to die in relation to her and go back to being alone, or I'm going to go with her. And maybe I'll die with her or whatever that means, but I'm going to breach this relationship that I have with God in order to maintain this fixation. Well, he tells the Corinthians something very clear about that. He says, when I'm writing to you, he says this in 1 Corinthians 3:1, I can't write to you as spiritual, but as carnal, as fleshly, as unto babes in Christ. And what he's saying is, when you come to Christ, when you are regenerated as a baby, your fixations that are screwed up, they've messed up your whole life, and now you're bringing all that fixation stuff with you as you come into the family of God. As a baby, you can't help that. It's just the natural reality. When you're regenerated, all that stuff doesn't just go away. You bring it with you. It's your excess baggage. Well, the whole problem there is that you're a baby, which means you can't think right. You're a babe in thinking. And the whole issue there is, as a baby, the baby's fixated on many things that are just not legitimate objects of confidence. But that's the way the baby is. And Paul says, I've got to get you out of this babyhood thing into some kind of level of maturity so that you can actually function as spiritual people. Well, what would be the difference between fleshly and spiritual then? Well, fleshliness means fixated on something less than legitimate objective, which in every case is God, because he's the only legitimate object of faith. And spirituality would be fixated on depending on God. We are spiritual when we are consciously aware of actively depending on God in his commitments to us, because that allows the Spirit of God then to take control of the heart and mind issues of our function, so we can present these members as instruments of righteousness in this world to God, and the Spirit of God is free to use them simply because we're consciously aware of an active dependence on God's promises and God's Word and God himself. And as a consequence of that faith, the Spirit of God is able and willing to express the truth about God through us. Well, that, I think, is the bottom line. He says the law is spiritual. It was designed for good goals, good reasons. It has a good function. It's designed for revelation in order to bring us to an understanding of things so that we can depend on God. And I'm fixated on the wrong things as a born again, alive once, deceived into death. Now I'm dead again in a very real sense because I've been deceived into twisting the law into something that's not. Therefore, my confidence is shifted. If the law is regulatory, then my confidence isn't on God performing, it's on me performing. If my confidence is shifted to that, then I'm fleshly, meaning I'm fixated on something that's not legitimate. I'm not depending on the Spirit of God. He's sitting over there in the corner. And I'm running my life now based on my desire to, well, there are all kinds of reasons why we become legalists, but my desire to perform enough to be accepted by God. And God says, that's not going to work and it's not going to happen. And therefore, you're basically telling me I'm a liar because I've told you this and you just don't buy it. And perhaps you don't buy it because you don't understand. But nonetheless, the bottom line is you're still calling me a liar and there's no relationship in that. You won't trust me when I tell you something because it contradicts your own fleshliness. This fixation's hard to break. So, I believe that's what's going on in verse 14. The law is spiritual. It points us to active dependence on God alone. And Paul, in his now dead state as a deceived believer, is not depending on the Spirit of God who actually dwells in him, but is not functioning because if you don't believe him, he doesn't function very well. And I say very well because we all know it's by grace. And so you can never say when God's going to do something that you don't expect because you're not trusting, but he does it anyway. Because that's just the kind of God he is. He just does things for us even when we're not trusting him, and then we're shocked by it, surprised by it, and humiliated by it, and sorry afterwards that we weren't trusting. But nonetheless, typically, if you don't trust him, you don't get the outcome of it. You can't have the joy and the peace and all that if you don't believe him. And Paul describes that as having been sold into bondage, or literally having been sold under sin. That translation, bondage to sin, is a translation of a phrase that simply means, I've been sold under the sin. And the idea of being sold just basically means that he's lost control of his own ability to function well, because now he's a slave. He has been sold out by the deception. In a very real sense, it's exactly what Adam did when he followed the serpent's temptation, took a bite. The serpent got all that Adam was supposed to have. Adam was created by God to be the underlord of this creation. Satan told Jesus in both the temptation accounts that he could give him the kingdoms of this world. To be able to give them means he has authority over them. Which, where did he get that? Well, he wouldn't have had it if he hadn't seduced Adam into his rebellion. So Adam was actually dragged off of his position as the underlord of the creation, and Satan took that position. So he was sold, in a very real sense, unto the sin. He was put under it. And this bondage is very real, because when you read verses 15 and 16, I'm doing what I don't understand. I'm not practicing what I'd like to do. I'm doing the very thing I hate. I do the very thing I don't wish to do. I agree with the law. No, 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 no. My life's a mess. I can't do what I want to do because I want to do what's right, but I can't do it. I don't want to do what's wrong, but I do it all the time. That kind of, and almost every believer latches immediately onto that because we experience it. We know what he's talking about. The condition is a direct result of him being deceived regarding the purpose of law in the first place. Paul says, after this, having gotten through that, he explains it by saying, the law is good. It had a good intention. It was designed for your life. But it was designed for your life as a tool of revelation from God. It was not designed for life as a tool of regulation from God. And because you got these things confused, you died. It's a direct result of being deceived about the function of law. Law's function is revelation. That's why the psalmist, or the, you know, the psalmist says, thy word is a light unto my feet and a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. That's revelation. That's true. So, in that regard, because he's deceived concerning the function, he is now spiritless in his mental fixations. not in reality. The spirit is still in his body. But in reality, his mind is fixated over here, and the spirit's over there. And instead of looking to the Spirit of God, he's looking to the law of God. And that'll kill you every time. And the outworking of that is a significant bondage that we'll get into if the Lord gives us opportunity in verses 15 and 16 and following. And he's got a way of explaining it all. But for this evening, the point is, the law of spirituality means that it was designed for revealing to men what was true about God and themselves so that they could depend on him, turn to him by faith. But men had gotten fixated on the secondary issues as the primary sources of their experience in life. And in that fixation of fleshliness, they died. It's always going to be the case. Every time some circumstance comes our way and we respond to it, not by faith, but by fixating on it and looking for something we can do about it, we will die. Our experience will be an experience of death. We'll have no peace, no joy, no contentment, no settled sense that this is going to work out okay. We'll just be torn up, upset, you know, and so on. So, personally, I'm glad we're looking at the issue in chapter 7 because I think it explains a lot of the discontent that believers live with.